Taking a break to rest and recharge didn't mean letting their guard down. Because the Rangers would have been upset to see them carrying weapons, the Brits kept their Glocks concealed beneath their shirts. Harvath was unarmed. He left the rear doors of LC-1 unlocked and made sure nothing was sitting on the rear bench. If anything happened and he needed a weapon, he would either take one off the Rangers or make a run for the shotgun under the back seat. He watched as the Rangers prepared lunch. When Jumbo explained how much they were charging for their beers, Harvath understood why they were throwing in lunch. When a small plastic bag with fresh meat came out, Harvath asked Jumbo what kind of meat it was.
"Bush meat," he replied.
Harvath immediately shook his head.
"No way."
"Why?"
Bush meat was the vehicle by which some of the worst diseases in Congo traveled. It was his op, and he wasn't going to risk anyone getting sick.
"Please tell the Rangers thank you, but we're vegetarians."
Jumbo looked at Harvath for a moment, trying to figure out how he was going to convincingly communicate this, but ultimately gave up and relayed the message to the Rangers. Why anyone would waste good bushmeat was beyond them, but they didn't care. It meant more food for them, and the money was the same. The Rangers' deal only got better. By the time it was Harvath's turn to grab a shower, the hot water had run out. He washed quickly, using the soap he had brought, being careful not to let any of the water get in his mouth or nose. The last thing he wanted was to get sick. The thought of it brought him back to the rebel camp and all of the men who had been masked up. Decker said she thought it was yellow fever. If she was right, he didn't have anything to worry about. It wasn't communicable unless an infected mosquito bit you, and he had already had the vaccine. But what if it wasn't yellow fever? What if it was something more serious? He tried to shake the thought from his mind. Everything in Congo seemed to be covered in a layer of clay-colored red dust. Turning off the shower, he toweled off with the only clean towel that was left, a small, lime-green hand towel with characters from a popular American children's movie. Finding slices of Western culture in the middle of a place like Congo always reminded him that the world was a lot smaller and interconnected than most people realized. As dry as he was going to get, Harvath dressed in fresh clothes and joined the rest of the team for lunch. While Jumbo had no problem eating the bushmeat, the rest of the team picked at stewed cassava leaves and boiled vegetables. When the meal was finished, the brute squad rested on the front porch, keeping one eye out for trouble while Ash and Mick gathered intel from the Rangers about the area they were heading into. Jumbo offered to clear the table, and as he took the stack of plates to the sink, Decker approached Harvath.
"Can I talk to you for a moment?" she asked.
Harvath nodded, and picking up his beer, followed her outside. They followed a rubble-strewn walkway to a clutter of lean-tos behind the station. Once she was satisfied that they were fully out of earshot of the men on the porch, Decker laid into him.
"Don't you ever pretend to be a doctor again. Do you understand me? I'm the doctor, and I'm in charge here."
Had Decker been a man, Harvath would have been torn between laughing and knocking him out. But since Decker was a woman, and he lived by the code that no man should ever strike a woman, even an astoundingly arrogant one, he chose the former. She glared at him.
"You're laughing? How dare you?"
It was time to put her in her place.
"Dr. Decker, I'm going to make this very clear so that there's no misunderstanding. This is not a medical assignment. You are here to assist me. That means you do what I say when I say it. If I tell you not to do something, then you don't do it. Do we understand each other?"
Decker's glare had turned into a glower.
"Your arrogance is astounding. Do you know that?"
"My arrogance?"
"Yes," she replied. "Your arrogance. It wasn't you who opened Matumeni Clinic. It wasn't you who poured sweat and blood into making it happen. And it wasn't you who lost very good friends there to God knows what. So yes, your arrogance is astounding."
She was in shock. That was the only charitable explanation he could think of. Their encounter with the rebels would have been traumatizing for any civilian, even a doctor who had previously been a war correspondent. Add to that the fact that she had already shown up for duty worried about the staff from the Matoumeni clinic, and you had a more than perfect recipe for psychological disaster.
"You've just been through a pretty intense,"
Harvath began.
"Don't you dare patronize me," she spat.
"No one is patronizing you."
"The hell you aren't."
Harvath needed to shut this down.
"Dr. Decker, I'm willing to cut you a little slack after what happened, but..."
"But what?"
she demanded, cutting him off again.
"Either you start pulling your act together, or I'm going to arrange to send you back."
That seemed to get her attention. Harvath watched her for a couple of seconds. He had known some emotional women in his day, but he had always thought it was demeaning to blame everything on emotion. People and arguments were usually more nuanced than that. There was, though, some convoluted chip that Decker carried on her shoulder. He had no idea where it came from, and he didn't want to know. That was for her shrink, or, God help him, her boyfriend to figure out. All Harvath cared about was whether or not she'd take orders, and whether or not he could count on her to see the rest of this operation through. He didn't like manipulating people, but Decker had positioned herself in such a manner that he had no problem doing whatever he needed to do. But before that, he wanted to make a couple more things crystal clear.
"After everything that happened this morning, we're very lucky that nobody died."
She looked at him, her eyes smoldering with incredulity.
"Nobody died? Nobody?"
Harvath corrected himself.
"We're very lucky that none of us died."
"So they don't matter?"
"The rebels?"
"Yes, the men back there that you killed, murdered in cold blood."
Good Lord, thought Harvath.
"All of those men were armed combatants."
"Who you shot before they could even get a chance to shoot you."
"What the?"
This woman was nuts.
"You know that's the idea, right? To shoot them before they can shoot me?"
In Harvath's short time on this earth, he had heard some incredibly stupid and incredibly offensive things, but that one was very near the top of his list.
"Do you think I enjoyed shooting those men?"
"I don't know,"
Decker replied.
"You tell me. You sure seem pretty good at it."
"I'm good at it, Dr. Decker, in the same way I'm sure you're good at what you do, because that's my job."
She had a triumphant expression on her face, as if she had just caught him in the lie to end all lies.
"Except my job is to save lives."
"Mine too."
"But,"
she began.
"But I've still killed people?"
he asked, interrupting her this time. Decker nodded.
"I have, and I would do it again, because some lives are more valuable than others."
Once more, the look of triumph flashed across her face, but Harvath shut it right down.
"Not every life is worth saving, Dr. Decker. In fact, some aren't even worth fighting for."
"All lives matter," she countered.
"The life of a Hitler? A Stalin? A Mao? A bin Laden?"
"The men we encountered this morning were not a Hitler, a Stalin, or a bin Laden," she replied.
"No, but they tied you up and gagged you just the same, right?"
Decker dismissed his question as if it were beneath her. Her ideology was more dangerous than Harvath had originally feared. Not only had she been willing to jump out of the Land Cruiser and go blindly into the jungle with anyone who asked, but she also appeared to lack the capability to feel any shame or responsibility for what had happened because of it. He was about ready to write her off for good when she made an interesting admission and asked him a question very few had ever asked.
"I don't get you," she said.
"Why not?"
"I assume you're a spy, or a soldier, or something."
"Or something,"
Harvath admitted. She looked at him long and hard, as if the answer to her next question would have to already be written on his face for her to believe it.
"Why do you do it?"
she asked.
"Any of it."
It wasn't a funny question, but Harvath laughed again anyway.
"You wouldn't believe me," he said.
"Try me."
She had said, "Try me," not "trust me." There were many explanations Harvath could have given her for why he had chosen the path he was on. One was his desire to please his deceased father, who had seldom been there for him because the man was always away chasing his own adventures. Another had to do with a desire to push himself further and challenge himself more. Yet another had to do with the fact that he was just plain addicted to the lifestyle and thought so highly of his ability that he had come to believe that he was the only person who could get the hard assignments done. There was another part to why he did what he did. It had started when he was much younger and lived next door to a developmentally impaired boy who was regularly picked on. He had inserted himself as the boy's protector, which resulted in him getting into a lot of fights. He got into a lot of trouble, but he also became a good fighter. Though he wanted to believe that what he was doing was noble, and it was, there was also a certain degree of selfishness to it. The boys he fought with were usually bigger than he was, and there was often more than one of them. Nevertheless, he beat them time and again, until no one challenged or made fun of his friend. It wasn't until he was older that he realized the gusto with which he had punched out any kid who made fun of the developmentally impaired boy came from a deeper place inside himself. What he did for that boy is what he wished his father had been around to do for himself and his mother. He was protecting him. He also came to realize that what he had voluntarily chosen to do for his neighbor, his Navy SEAL father, had also voluntarily chosen to do for others. There would always be people who needed the protection of others. True nobility came in offering that protection freely. Once he came to fully accept that idea, his path in life became pretty clear. Looking at Decker, he said,
"We talk a lot back home about the American dream. Without someone willing to protect it, it can't exist."
"You're right," she replied. "I don't believe you." So much for building rapport, Harvath thought. Not that he was surprised. He could tell that they had much different world views.
"Your belief in why I do what I do notwithstanding, I need to know whether or not I can count on you moving forward," he said.
"That depends."
"Sorry, I need a yes or no answer. No contingencies, no qualifiers. Either you agree to do what I say, or you're not going back out with us."
Decker was quiet for several moments.
"I really thought those soldiers were Congolese military. I wouldn't have gone with them had I known they weren't."
Harvath didn't know what to make of her statement. It almost sounded like an apology. Regardless, it showed she was capable of insight, which went a big way toward fixing the problem.
"I'm not saying you can't help people. That's what you do. I understand that. But right now, our job is to figure out what happened to the people at the Matumeni Clinic. That needs to be our focus. Agreed?"
Whatever storm had been raging inside of Decker, it seemed to be receding. Her face had softened, and her posture was less aggressive.
"Agreed," she said.
Harvath looked at his watch and computed how much daylight they had left. If Ash and his team were on board, he wanted to push to make it to the clinic before nightfall. The sooner he was out of Congo, the better. Chapter 12. After negotiating for some extra fuel and water at the ranger station, the team headed out. Typical Congo. Everything was fine, until it wasn't. They traversed two relatively shallow rivers, only to discover that they had built an inflated sense of confidence when it came to a third. It was much deeper and faster than the others. The water rose almost to the windows, and at one point, both land cruisers began being pushed downstream. As they started to rock and threatened to roll over, Ash passed the word to be ready to bail out. Luckily, the heavy tires finally bit into the riverbed, found purchase, and moved them over and onto the opposite bank. They had made it through the worst of it. From that point forward, it would only be ruts, bumps, and mud. Harvath turned his attention out his window. Before leaving the ranger station, he had checked his phone again. He was using it in conjunction with a satellite system that would allow him to send and receive text messages, as well as make phone calls, as long as he had a relatively unimpeded view of the sky. Lara had still not replied to any of his messages. He didn't like the fact that he was thinking about her while he was on assignment. He was supposed to compartmentalize these things. He had chastised other operatives in the field for making the same mistake. If your head wasn't 100% in the game, you quickly became a trouble magnet. This wasn't like him. He usually kept everything wired tight. Part of it was because he knew Lara was pissed at him and had every right to be. He had told her that he had taken this assignment because he had to. That much was true. He believed he was the best person to handle the job. But that would have been true of almost any assignment that the Carlton Group had been tasked with. Where he had lied to her was in telling her he had no choice. Of course he had a choice. He could have said no. The thing was, he didn't want to say no. He wanted to take this assignment because he hadn't done something like it before. He relished the challenge. He also knew that the trip with Lara was about a lot more than watching the fall colors. She was ready to start having the talk. He hadn't realized how disinterested he was in having that talk until he arrived in Congo. No matter what any woman said to the contrary, at some point, he'd be forced to make a choice. He couldn't have a family and keep this career. He had grown up watching what that was like. It was rough on everyone. But what Harvath did now was 10 times different from what his father had done. His father had gone into hostile nations accompanied by his SEAL team. Harvath, though, often went into hostile nations alone. He took bigger risks than his father and couldn't imagine how he would be able to keep on doing that with a family back at home. For the longest time, he had wanted his own piece of the American dream. But now, he was no longer sure what that dream looked like. He didn't know how he could have his and protect everyone else's. He was also concerned about the consequences of obtaining the American dream. Would having a family back home cause him to dial down his risk-taking in the field? Might that get him or someone else killed? Or was it more than that? Was he afraid that no matter how many visions he had had to the contrary, this, what he was doing right now, was what he was really cut out for, and not family life? It was an idea he had kept relegated to a very cold, dark corner of his mind, one that he never fed, hoping that by ignoring it, it would slip away and disappear. But it hadn't disappeared. In fact, it had only grown. He slammed an iron gate down on his thoughts and focused on what lay ahead. Another potential run-in with Ash and his team was looming. The Brits were going to want to accompany him right up to the clinic's front door. Harvath couldn't allow that, not with what he knew might be waiting for them. He hadn't brought enough equipment. Somehow, he would have to convince them to hang back. The turnoff for the road to the Matumeni clinic was so poorly marked that they drove right past it. It took 6 kilometers before Ash and Mick realized their error, and the Land Cruisers doubled back. Without someone regularly chopping away at it, the jungle quickly swallowed up anything left unattended. The Matumeni road was worse than anything they had previously seen. Halfway to the clinic, the road was sliced open by deep washout several feet wide. Ash had Simon and Eddie bring up the bridging ladders strapped to LC2. As the men maneuvered the beams into place, Harvath pulled Ash aside.
"I want to talk about the footprint we're going to have when we get to the clinic," he said.
Keeping one eye on the brute squad, Ash replied,
"Fine. What do you have in mind?"
"I want to keep it light."
"How light?"
"Just me and Dr. Decker."
"You're the client, and you can do whatever you want, but I have to tell you that I think it's a bad idea. We don't know what might be waiting there. A quick web search for Care International is all the FRPI would need."
"That's assuming any of the rebels who saw the door magnets are still alive," stated Harvath.
"And that there was no radio transmission by them before we took them out."
"If I was stuck in one place, hiding a critically ill rebel commander, I wouldn't be putting out a lot of radio traffic."
"Neither would I," Ash agreed. "But it still needs to be considered. We could be walking into an ambush. Hell, a few more kilometers and we could be driving into one.
Which is why I want you guys to hang back. We'll get the vehicles off the road, set up camp, and then Dr. Decker and I will go the rest of the way on foot and check it out.
You want to go in tonight? In the dark?
Harvath checked his watch again. By the time they found a place to camp and got the trucks out of sight, it would indeed be dark.
I think it's the best way.
You don't need all of us to stay behind. Mick and I'll go with you. If you run into trouble, you'll have two extra trigger pullers with you. How's that sound?
In any other situation, it would have sounded like a great plan. But Harvath and Decker needed to go in alone.
I appreciate it, but it's just going to be the two of us.
Your call,
Ash replied with a shake of his head. Harvath thanked him and then steered the conversation to where they should set up camp. He pulled up the satellite images stored on his phone, careful not to reveal any pictures of the burn pit, and gave the Brit an idea of where he thought they could stash the land cruisers and make camp. Once the Brute Squad had piloted both vehicles over the washout, the team remounted the ladders and they headed deeper into the jungle toward the Matumeini Clinic. As they drove, Harvath made a mental list of the gear he would need. Most of it, particularly the scary stuff as Beeman had called it, had already been pre-packed into two large backpacks. The amount of kit he and Decker would be humping in was far too much for just a reconnaissance. It was going to raise a few eyebrows with the Brits, but Harvath figured he could once again use the specter of the rebels to his advantage. Ash and his men, technically, had no idea what was in the packs. All they had been told was they were filled with medical supplies for the Matumeini Clinic. They had no reason to believe otherwise. Harvath would explain that he and Decker planned to cache this load of supplies in the jungle, not far from the clinic. If the rebels were already there, the clinic staff could wait until the coast was clear and then go pick everything up. If the rebels weren't there, they would empty their packs, come back to get the Brits, and then deliver the rest via the vehicles to the clinic's front door. He had no idea how well that would go down with Ash and his team, but as long as they did what he told them, that was all he cared about. 2 kilometers from the clinic, they left the road and drove several hundred meters into the bush. The jungle was alive, raucous with the calls of birds and all sorts of other animals. Simon and Eddie set up camp, while Ash and Mick returned to the road to cover their tracks. It wasn't perfect, but unless someone knew exactly where to look for them, nobody was going to find them. Jumbo worked on getting dinner started. Like the rebels from that morning, theirs would be a cold camp, no campfire. Cooking smells could draw unwanted human as well as animal visitors. Jumbo used jet boil stoves to heat water. When it reached boiling, he poured it into bags of freeze-dried camping food and zipped them shut to steam. Harvath had brought food for himself and Decker from the United States. He hated the pre-cooked rations used by the military, known as MREs. While the acronym stood for Meals Ready to Eat, service members normally referred to them as Meals Rejected by Everyone. This was his op, and he intended to eat what he wanted to eat. Because of the stress assignments often created, and as he was trying to bulk back up, he had focused on high-calorie meals. One of his favorites was biscuits and gravy. He told Jumbo to make sure to boil him enough water for 2 bags. There was no telling how long he and Decker would be gone. Whatever they faced, he planned to do it on a full stomach. For Decker, he had thrown in a bunch of meals from a new company doing gourmet camping meals, such as all-natural, gluten-free mushroom risotto, as well as wild salmon marinara with penne. Something had told him she was going to be a high-maintenance pain in the ass, and in his experience, nothing dragged an op down quicker than someone who wasn't eating properly. They not only didn't get the necessary amount of calories to function well, but they also complained incessantly about being hungry. While his meal steamed, he pulled the 2 packs he wanted from the back of LC2 and hefted them for weight. Both were heavy. Decker would have to suck it up. He couldn't reveal what they contained and repack them here in front of everyone. She would have to wait. Once they were far enough away from the Brits, he'd work on lightening her load. setting the packs off to the side. He covered each with a poncho. It felt like rain again. Simon and Eddie strung jungle hammocks between a series of trees. Being up off the ground would protect the team from snakes, and the tented tarps overhead would keep them dry. Harvath threw a set of dry clothes into his hammock, along with his sleeping bag, and his CRKT hook-and-loop tool. It had been beaten into him as a seal to clean his equipment immediately after an operation. That included his boots. The ingenious little Trip Felton tool had a pick that would be perfect for scraping off the pounds of mud he knew he'd be dragging back. He gave the hammock lines a tug. The Brute Squad had done a good job. He looked forward to coming back, servicing his gear, and then climbing inside and going to sleep, the Matumani reconnaissance far behind him. Of course, that would assume that everything had gone well, something Harvath knew better than to expect, especially in Congo. Chapter 13. The biggest impediment they faced in walking to the clinic, beyond the weight of their packs, was the amount of water they needed. It was imperative that they be well hydrated before going in, but that was nothing compared to the amount of water they'd need on their way out. Harvath had known this was going to be a problem, even before leaving the States, and had planned accordingly. They couldn't depend on the clinic's well. If it didn't work, it could result in a death sentence. Harvath had seen enough wells fail to know better than to tie his survival to one in Congo. Following the narrow river upstream to where it snaked behind the clinic would take them out of their way and increase the likelihood that they would bump into locals, but it would keep them off the road where they might bump into rebels, and it would solve their water issue. It made complete and total sense, except to Dr. Decker. "You can't do this," she admonished him, once she had figured out what he was doing. "Watch me. You really are a selfish asshole, you know that?" Harvath had to take a breath and remind himself again that a gentleman never strikes a lady. "You've never had a well go bad before?" he asked, as he finished rebalancing her pack and cinched its top down. "That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about you being willing to wash God knows what we'll find downriver. Do you know how many people you could end up killing?" Harvath unzipped a compartment on his pack and unrolled 4 canvas buckets. "If you want to set up shop farther away from the river, that's fine by me," he said, tossing 2 of the buckets to her. "But you're going to carry your own water. Mine too, since we're partners." Decker shot him a disparaging look and chided him. "Don't you have any sense of moral obligation?" "My moral obligation is simple. I figure out what happened at Matumani, and I make sure we get out of here alive. Anything beyond that is not my problem."
"How about we try to leave this place better than we found it?"
"Put it on a bumper sticker," he said, standing up and holding her pack out to her. "This should be more comfortable now." Decker took it and almost felt guilty over how much he had lightened it. He had removed a good 40 pounds. His act of kindness notwithstanding, she was still angry at his lack of concern over the lives of the locals. But before she could say anything else, or even swing her pack onto her back, he had picked up his now considerably heavier rucksack and was moving upstream. He had an answer for everything, even when his answer was silence. It was infuriating. The real salt in the wound, though, had been the lecture he had given her as they walked away from camp. After warning her about not wanting a repeat of what had happened that morning, he had threatened to tie her to a tree and leave her for the pygmies if she didn't follow all of his instructions to the letter. He had said it with a boyish smile, but it failed to disarm her. She could see right through him. Harvath obviously had a problem with women, especially smart, accomplished women. He was nothing more than a caveman, a handsome caveman, but a caveman nonetheless.
"Hey," she said, trotting to catch up as he moved along the river. "Are you this much fun with your wife?"
"Not married," he replied and kept moving.
"Imagine that," Decker quipped.
Harvath ignored her. They walked on in silence for 20 more minutes until he stopped and checked his GPS. He took a long look around and then motioned for Decker to follow him up the riverbank
and into the jungle. It was slow going. He used a machete he had borrowed from Jumbo to help cut a path. Several minutes later, he stopped and turned to look at her.
"Far enough from the river?" he asked.
Decker nodded, not knowing whether to be pleased with herself or not. The bottom line was that he had taken what she had said to heart.
"Good," he replied, taking off his pack. "I'm going to clear the rest of this brush. You start getting the water."
She dropped her pack near his and disappeared back down the path, the red LEDs of her headlamp lighting her way. While she went to get the water, Harvath screwed the PVC poles together and hung the plastic sheeting. Next, he filled the canisters with the powder and set their lids next to them. In the tens of thousands of hours that had gone into establishing the protocols, he was positive that no one had ever envisioned something this primitive. The ground was soft, and he used the machete to trench a berm. It would help prevent the runoff from going all the way downhill and into the river. It was an additional peace offering. Decker had been right. They needed to take all reasonable precautions. They needed to keep it out of the river. If she bitched about it ending up in the groundwater, there was obviously no pleasing her, and he would tie her to a tree and make good on his threat to leave her for the pygmies. By the time Decker came back, he had finished clearing their staging area, had unrolled the enormous bladder, and had positioned it inside its multi-point sling. He walked her through everything, and, after helping her fill the first canister with water, told her what he wanted her to do if he wasn't back in an hour. She wasn't happy about being left alone. Handing her the machete, Harvath made her repeat what he had told her. To the letter, she repeated his instructions. She had expected him to leave her with a final admonition over what had happened that morning, but to his credit, he didn't. Instead, he smiled and told her everything would be okay. Then, flipping his night vision goggles back down, he walked into the jungle and was gone. Based on his GPS reading at the river and a review of the satellite imagery saved to his phone, Harvath had a good idea where the clinic was, along with the best way to approach. It took him less than 10 minutes to find it. When he did, he remained in the jungle. He didn't dare enter the clearing. In his mind, there was a bright red circle painted around the building. He wasn't going to cross that line without having taken every single precaution possible. He low-crawled to the edge of the clearing, parted the vegetation, and peered through his goggles. There was no movement to be seen, but even more unusual was the fact that there wasn't a sound coming from anywhere. It was as if even the animals were avoiding this place. The quiet was unsettling. Harvath tried to shake it off. Retreating into the jungle, he worked his way around the perimeter. There were no trucks or vehicles of any sort. No light came from inside the clinic. It looked completely abandoned. Arriving at the northwest corner of the clearing, he looked at his watch. He wanted to check out the burn pit, too, but he'd be pushing it time-wise. He wasn't sure if Decker would honor his instructions or not, but if he wasn't back in an hour, he had to expect that she'd be gone. And if she was gone, he would have to abandon the operation. While he hadn't liked the idea of bringing Decker along, he couldn't escape the fact that it was a two-person job. He wouldn't have been able to suit up without her. The reconnaissance, though, would be incomplete without checking the pit, so he decided to push it. He could smell the pit long before he could see it. More appropriately, he could smell the accelerant that had been used. Jet fuel had a unique odor, but the nearest airport was hundreds of kilometers away. How the hell had jet fuel ended up in the middle of the jungle? For the moment, that question would have to remain unanswered. Nearing the pit, he stopped and listened. When he didn't hear anything, he crept forward to take a look. There was no sign of anyone, but someone had been there, and they had come through with heavy vehicles, one of which was on treads. A bulldozer, Harvath thought to himself. Not a good sign. The only reason you brought in something that big was if you had something very large to unearth or to cover up. though he had never held out much hope for the staff and patients of the Matumeni Clinic, he had held out some. The revelation that a bulldozer had likely been involved in the pit now dashed that hope. It also raised his concern as to who had staged the alleged attack on the clinic. Hazmat suits, jet fuel, and earth-moving equipment spoke to a very high level of sophistication. He wanted to examine more of the pit. There was still that question poking at the back of his mind from when he had seen the original satellite footage of it. Something hadn't made sense. Was it the shape of the pit? The part where the heat was concentrated? Unfortunately, he was out of time. He needed to get back before Decker took off. Retracing his steps, he moved as quickly and as quietly as he could. Chapter 14. By the time he got back to Decker, she had completely filled the canisters and was almost done filling the bladder.
"What did you see?" she asked. "Is anyone at the clinic?"
He shook his head.
"Everything's quiet."
Pointing at her empty buckets, he added,
"Want me to finish the bladder?"
"Thanks,"
she replied. Taking Jumbo's machete, he chopped off a tree branch about the diameter of a closet rod, notched it in two places at both ends, and then, picking up his buckets as well as Decker's, headed down to the river. When he returned, with the pole across his shoulders and two buckets on each side, Decker was drinking from one of the large plastic water bottles they had brought in with them.
"You want some?"
she asked, holding the bottle out to him.
"No, you finish it,"
he answered, as he set the buckets of water down.
"You're going to need it."
"So are you."
She was right. Now was as good as any time to get started. He pulled a bottle from his pack, twisted off the top, and guzzled over half of it. Then he turned his attention to the canvas sling that held the bladder. A gallon of water weighed almost 8.5 pounds. While he figured they would only need 10 to 15 gallons apiece, he had specced a 40-gallon bladder, just in case. Not counting the powdered chemicals he had added, the weight of which was negligible, the bladder clocked in at over 300 pounds. Once they were a safe distance away from the river, he had begun looking for a level piece of ground with a strong enough tree. That's how he had chosen where to stop. Into each of the sling's heavy-duty grommets, he attached a carabiner, which itself was attached to a cable leading to a hoist ring. He removed a ratchet lever hoist, suspended it from the tree limb, and went to work lifting the bladder. When he had it at the level he wanted, he moved the PVC frame underneath it, extended the hose, and tried the nozzle. The water was cold, but it smelled clean, and the pressure was excellent. He positioned the supplies they would need and then returned to the bottle of water sitting next to his pack. As he was drinking, Decker tossed him a pair of surgical scrubs.
"Time to get dressed," she said.
He half expected her to either retreat down the path or behind the opaque sheeting affixed to the makeshift PVC shower stall, but she didn't bother. Instead, standing next to her own pack, Decker began to slowly get undressed. Apparently, modesty wasn't one of her strong suits. Neither was subtlety. Harvath didn't want to watch, but he couldn't help himself. The way in which she took off her clothes practically begged for a cover charge and a 2-drink minimum. He disliked everything about her, but when her mouth was shut and her clothes were dropping to the ground, she wasn't half bad. The only reason he shifted his eyes away was because he didn't want to give her the satisfaction of knowing he was looking. As he focused on getting himself undressed, he had to give her points for style. If he had been a woman traveling in the wilds of Congo, he doubted a thong and a sexy bra would have been on his packing list. Shaking his head, he continued to get undressed. She was a boatload of trouble, and he figured she probably knew it. Her undoubtedly expensive lingerie was completely impractical and totally out of place in the middle of the jungle. She had to have known that, too. It was, of course, total theater, but in one of the crummiest places in the world, Jessica Decker had decided that the show must go on. He had to give her an A for effort. Any man who couldn't applaud, or at the very least, appreciate her dedication to maintaining a modicum of sex appeal, didn't deserve to call himself a man. While it didn't mean he had any intention of hanging an open for business sign on his hammock, he decided to sneak one more peek. When he did, he found that she was already looking at him, admiring his body. Their eyes met. They were both completely naked, and they held each other's gaze for several beats, longer than they should have. It was Harvath who eventually broke it off and looked away. That word that rhymed with truck leapt back into his mind. It might have been a game to Decker, but he knew he had to be careful. Hanging off a skyscraper, only a fool whipped out his knife and started sawing away at the rope. It was amazing, though, how foolish even the most resolute of men could be. Thankfully, when he looked back over, Decker was nearly dressed. She made a show of pulling the top of her scrubs over her breasts before smoothing it down. She was trouble, all right, and she definitely knew it. Harvath, though, had enough other things to think about and shifted his mind to those. Taking only the bare minimum of things they would need, he repacked Decker's ruck and covered it with one of their ponchos. He used the other poncho to cover a hole he had dug and needed to keep dry. There had been no rain since they had left the Brits back at camp. For the time being, Mother Nature seemed to be smiling on them, or at least unaware of their presence. When Decker indicated that she was ready, Harvath struck off toward the clinic. The idea was to get as close as possible before climbing into the stifling heat of their biohazard suits. At most, they would be good for a half hour, and even then, it would feel like they had done an Ironman race in 100-degree heat. Dehydration and heat stroke were very serious concerns, which was why they had been drinking water and would be watching the clock once they were suited up. At the clinic's perimeter, Harvath took a long look around and then removed his night vision goggles and allowed Decker to take a look. His primary goal was to put her at ease. If she was at all nervous, the stress would erode the amount of time she could remain in her suit. His secondary goal was to give her an opportunity to reacquaint herself with the property and see if she noticed anything out of place. After a couple of minutes, she handed the goggles back to him.
"Does it look the way you remembered it?" he asked.
"Pretty much."
"Okay, let's get suited up."
Unpacking his ruck, Harvath laid out their gear in stacks of his and hers. Though they had already examined the suits, gloves, hoods, and booties for punctures, tears, or any other vulnerability whatsoever, they went through each pile once more and then switched, checking each other's work. Content that the suits had not been compromised, they began climbing into their personal protective equipment, also known as PPE. The process required multiple pairs of sterile gloves, and each one had to be taped to your suit. The tape had to be applied in a very specific manner, so as not to tent, which might provide an opening for a virus or other deadly pathogens to get in. This was one of the biggest reasons Harvath had been overruled, and Decker was along for the assignment. A person not only needed help donning their PPE, but it was crucial to have help in doffing it. It simply wasn't possible to properly remove the suit on one's own. Decker had been through extensive training and knew what she was doing. She stepped Harvath through what he needed to do as her partner. When he asked about the multiple pairs of gloves, she explained that while they were a protection against the outermost level being punctured or torn, their primary raison d'etre was to provide uncontaminated gloves beneath the outer gloves in order to help you get out of your suit. The whole process, right down to getting out of your boots and slithering out of the suit, was like the board game Operation. Touch the sides at any time, and that was it. It came down to partnership and absolute trust. While Decker may have pissed him off immeasurably with her behavior that morning, right now, she radiated professionalism. Taping the seams at his wrists and ankles, running her hands over the exterior of his suit, all of it was expert and clinical. However coquettish she may or may not have intended to be while getting into her scrubs, all of that was gone now. Jessica Decker was 100% business. They were going through the final stages of taping when Harvath heard her curse. At first, he thought he had done something wrong. Then he saw what had triggered the expletive. A large raindrop had landed on her face panel. It was quickly followed by another, and then another. Without any preamble, the clouds had opened up, and the rain was now pounding down. Congo.
"We need to work fast," Decker shouted over the din, "but methodically. Don't screw up."
Harvath did as she instructed, taking great care to make sure his tape didn't tent. They were working beneath their headlamps, which had been wrapped around a tree limb. It was already less than optimal conditions. The rain only made it worse. When he was done, Harvath flashed her the thumbs up. She examined her seams, then his. It was now that faith entered the equation. They had either done everything right, or they hadn't. Only time would tell. Taking a step back, Decker moved out of the way so that Harvath could lead. The suit was extremely uncomfortable. Because of its bulk, his range of motion was severely limited. He felt like the Midwestern boy in A Christmas Story, whose mother had overbundled him with umpteen layers against the severe winter walk to school. The hood not only impacted his hearing, but it also narrowed his field of view. His peripheral vision was all but non-existent. Usually, they would have taken each other's vitals before suiting up, but they didn't have the luxury of allowing vitals to dictate go or no-go for this assignment. After powering up a small IR video camera, Harvath stepped into the clearing and kept his head on a swivel as they walked toward the clinic. He had told Decker to inform him right away if anything seemed out of place. Twice he looked back at her, and twice she flashed him the thumbs up. From across the clearing, the clinic had somehow looked more formidable, more robust. The closer they came, the more shabby and run down it became. He had thought that maybe it was a trick of the rain streaming down his faceplate, but it wasn't. Like everything else in Congo, even this American-funded medical clinic was woefully underwhelming. There was a crappy, hand-painted wooden sign above the dilapidated covered entrance. Written in French and English, it read, "Care International, Matumeni Medical Clinic." Its ridiculously hopeful blue shutters were drawn flush against the chipped and peeling white facade. The faded front door was also closed. Standing beneath the overhang, Harvath wiped the rain from his faceplate and then leaned in to study the door.
"What is it?" Decker asked.
With his finger, he pointed to a discolored inch-and-a-half wide strip around the frame.
"Something was taped over this door at one point," he said.
And then, examining the windows on either side, he added,
"The windows were too. Stay here."
Before Decker could respond, he had already stepped out from under the overhang and into the rain to examine the rest of the structure. She didn't like being left alone, especially not right at the front door. What if someone was inside? What if that someone came out? How would she protect herself? Decker willed herself to calm down. This was her clinic. She used to be in charge here. There was nothing to worry about. Staring out into the rain, she thought about all the people she had worked with here. They were good people, hard-working people, whose only sin was to have been born in Congo. Why someone would attack this clinic was beyond her. In fact, why someone would attack any clinic was beyond her. It was that kind of senselessness that had made her want to stop reporting tragedies and become part of making people's lives better. They had done that at the Matumeni Clinic, and she hoped they would be able to do it again. A rumble of thunder echoed from somewhere off in the distance. Decker took a step back and pressed herself against the wall. It was pitch black, and the rain was coming down in sheets. She couldn't make out where the clinic grounds ended and the jungle began. Nevertheless, Someone was watching. She could feel it. She had sensed eyes on them from the moment they had stepped out of the jungle. She wished she still had the machete. Something wasn't right. No sooner had that thought popped into her mind than she heard the sound of glass breaking from inside the clinic. Chapter 15. Lying in the sill to Decker's left was a short piece of rebar used for propping open the window. She grabbed it. It wasn't much of a weapon, but it was something. There was another noise from inside, followed by the groan of metal on metal and the scraping of wood against stone as the faded front door creaked and began to open. She made ready to strike until she saw the outline of Harvath's hazmat suit as he stepped out of the clinic.
What the hell are you doing? I thought you were checking the exterior of the building.
I saw enough. Come inside.
Decker followed him. Parts of the interior were illuminated with an eerie greenish glow. Harvath had brought along a box of his own full-sized chem lights and was snapping and tossing them into various corners as he went. They provided enough light to see by, but not so much that it would be noticed from outside.
What was that crash I heard? Decker asked.
Nothing, Harvath replied. I had to break a window to get in.
Let me check the integrity of your suit.
I'm fine.
He was already overheating and not in a good mood.
Let me check, Decker insisted.
Harvath complied, and she pulled out her headlamp, activated the low-level red beam, and examined him from head to toe.
You're good.
Thanks, he said. Now, come look at this.
He led her into the main ward. It was a graveyard of metal bed frames. All of the mattresses had been stripped away. There wasn't a sheet or blanket to be seen either.
It's like a swarm of locusts came through here, Decker stated. Even the mosquito netting and privacy dividers are gone.
All of the bed frames had been jumbled together in the center of the ward. Harvath pulled a large plastic bottle of liquid from his bag and began spraying it in different places around the room.
What's that? She asked.
Luminol. It reacts with the iron and hemoglobin. If there's any blood in here, it'll start glowing blue.
Decker waited, but she didn't see anything. Neither did Harvath.
There,
she suddenly said, pointing to an area glowing in the corner.
And there. And there.
Harvath turned and looked at each occurrence, along with several others that were actively glowing.
My God, Decker exclaimed. There's blood everywhere.
Take it easy, replied Harvath,
as he began spraying more luminol around the room. He even stood on one of the bed frames to spray several spots along the ceiling. All of them started to glow blue.
How is that possible? She asked. It's like the whole ward was painted in blood.
Not exactly, he said,
as he exited the ward and made his way through the clinic, randomly spraying walls, doors, floors, windows, and ceilings with the luminol.
It's all glowing, he heard her shout as she trailed behind him. Every single thing you're spraying.
She caught up with him in the small dispensary that also acted as the clinic's laboratory. Harvath was spraying the small, empty refrigerator. It all glowed blue.
I don't understand, she said.
There's only two other substances that can cause luminol to glow like this, and I don't think it's the first one.
What's the first one?
Harvath got out an S and an H before catching himself and saying,
excrement.
And the second?
Decker asked.
Bleach.
Bleach?
He nodded.
I think this entire place has been sanitized, literally, from top to bottom. I also think, he began,
but his voice trailed off as something caught his eye.
What is it?
Harvath motioned for her to back out of the dispensary. He had been bending down near the tiny fridge and saw something beneath the cabinets on the adjacent wall. There was a narrow strip of black plastic trim along the top of the fridge that had begun to peel back on one side. Harvath helped it the rest of the way off. Lying down on his stomach, he slid the piece of trim under the cabinets and coaxed out the item from underneath. Once he got it out, he held it up.
What is it?
Decker repeated from the doorway. It looked like a giant mint, the size of a hockey puck. It was chipped, and a large portion appeared to have been burned.
No one ever used these when you were here? I don't even know what it is.
Harvath sprayed it with luminol. Seconds later, it started to glow.
It's a bleach tablet, he said.
Why would that be here?
Drop this in a pie plate and set it on top of a camping stove, and you can gasify it. The fumes go everywhere and will sanitize anything your liquid bleach missed.
Then you're right. The clinic was sanitized.
But by whom? And why? What were they sanitizing? Good questions. None of which Harvath wanted to waste time deciphering right now. His scrubs were soaked through, and the sweat was rolling down his face into his eyes. He wanted to finish looking around and get the hell out of here. Retreating to the front door, he reenacted what he had seen on the video. Though someone outside had filmed it, he could approximate where the shooters had been standing when they entered and had opened fire. In his restrictive biohazard suit, Harvath pantomimed a tactical entry, stepping inside with a rifle and shooting. If the shooters had been following the same protocols he was, they might have wanted a few modifications to their weapons. Wearing the layers of gloves, the more refined features of the weapons would be difficult to manipulate. Perhaps they had upgraded to larger trigger guards and beefier charging handles to accommodate their thicker, less dexterous fingers. It was also possible that for such a quick in-and-out assignment, where no resistance would have been expected, the men had just made do with whatever weapons they normally carried or had access to. There was no way of knowing for sure. What he was able to know for sure came from examining the wall directly opposite the front door. Based on the furniture scattered nearby, it had been some sort of clerical or nurse's station, likely the place patients checked in and then were shown to a row of chairs where they would wait to see one of the clinic's medical staff. He ran his hand up and down the entire wall.
What do you see? Decker asked him.
It's not what I see, said Harvath, but what I don't see. There are no bullet holes, at least not anymore. Look.
She bent down and studied the places he pointed to.
Whoever this was, he continued, they were absolute professionals. They did a full cleanup job, right down to digging out the bullets and patching and painting the walls.
While Decker looked for any records of what might have been going on at the clinic, Harvath examined the walls and floor in the ward and found more evidence of the walls having been repaired. He was convinced that whoever it was had come in, killed the staff, and then had murdered all of the patients. He didn't need to ask where their bodies had been taken. He already knew. Decker rejoined him from the back of the clinic and shook her head.
I can't find anything, she said.
I'm not surprised, he replied. Don't worry, we've seen enough. Let's get out of here.
Decker nodded, and they exited the clinic. Harvath went first. As was his habit, he took a long, slow look around before signaling that it was safe for her to join him. It was still raining, and the moment they stepped out from under the overhang, the rain began streaking down their faceplates. Neither of them cared. They were both bordering on heatstroke. All that mattered was getting out of the suits. Re-entering the jungle, they retraced their steps to where they had positioned the canisters. Harvath had already mixed the solution inside, but he picked up each one and gave it a good shake before pumping their handles up and down. It was a maddening process to have to go through when you were this uncomfortable, but because their lives depended on it, they took extra precautions not to rush things. They had made it this far. It was only a little bit further. Now was not the time to be cutting any corners. Decker reminded Harvath to take a deep breath. It was thick with humidity, but he did so anyway. She then lifted the wand attached to her canister and began spraying him down. He lifted his arms in the air and turned in a slow circle. She stopped to pump the handle and then had him repeat the process. He did the same for her. They did it again and again,
until they had both exhausted 2 full canisters of the solution. Then came the hard part, doffing the PPE. All sorts of horrible diseases had infected untold numbers of medical workers over the years, not because their suits had failed, but because they had failed to properly remove those suits. Next to visiting an outbreak, the next most dangerous step involved was slithering out of the suit. The doffing procedure required steely patience and total concentration. Slowly, carefully, Decker walked him through every step. Their scrubs and everything else went into the hole he had previously dug and packed with tinder. While Decker showered, he doused the pile of gear with some of the kerosene he'd asked the Brits to source for the clinic. As soon as the fire was burning good and hot, it was his turn to shower. He stood under the water and used the soap and shampoo to clean himself from top to bottom. His PPE had held, and he was confident they had followed all the doffing procedures correctly. He wasn't a hypochondriac and didn't need to scrub himself raw. He allowed the lukewarm water to trickle over his neck and shoulders. He was glad the clinic part was over. They would have to go back and check the burn pit, but it was pro forma at this point, and at least he wouldn't have to get back in one of those suits. It did indeed feel like he had competed in an Ironman race in 100-degree heat. He reached down for one of the water bottles mixed with Gatorade powder he had left on the edge of the shower, but it wasn't there. Straightening up, he saw Decker. She was standing there, naked, just looking at him with the bottle of Gatorade in her hand. Then, she stepped into the shower. Chapter 16. Harvath was exhausted. So was Decker. He wanted to take a closer look at the burn pit, but now wasn't the time. Not in the dark and the rain. It was time to get back to camp. Shouldering their packs, they walked down to the river and returned the way they had come. The rain made it difficult to talk, and it was probably for the best. Decker had already made going to the burn pit an issue. She wanted to go with him in the morning. Harvath had no idea what she had seen as a war correspondent, but he had strongly advised her against it. There were certain things that couldn't be unseen. Once they were seared into your mind, they stayed there forever. The additional reason he felt she should sit it out was that she had personal relationships with the people missing from the clinic. Based on what little he had seen, he knew the pit was going to be brutal. Decker, though, had her mind made up. No matter how hard he might try to dissuade her, she intended to join him. There was no use fighting her on it, and he let the subject drop. When they entered the camp, they found the Brits, along with